Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in American Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Lane, the host of the channel. When we talk about stories of alien abduction in the United States, we often do so through a framework of belief versus disbelief. Do I think this story is true, or do I think it's false? Anthropologist Susan Lepselter asks what happens when we instead listen to UFO talk ethnographically, understanding it as a form of vernacular American poetics that must be made sense of within specific cultural, political, and historical contexts. In The Resonance of Unseen Things, Lepselter draws on years of interviews with experiencers, those who tell of being abducted by aliens, and participant observation at an experiencer's support group in a southern U.S. city. Her wide-ranging book considers abduction stories in relation to other narrative forms, captivity narratives, conspiracy theories, frontier tales, offering new and shifting frameworks for making sense of the weird, the uncanny, the random, and the real. I hope you'll join us in hearing more about Dr. Susan Lepselter's new book.
I'm thrilled to be talking today with Dr. Susan Lepselter, author of The Resonance of Unseen Things, Poetics, Power, and UFOs in the American Uncanny, published by University of Michigan Press in 2016. Dr. Lepselter, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're super happy to have you here. I figure if we could just begin, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, went to school, your life outside this book?
Yeah, sure. So I was born in New Jersey and grew up there and in Pennsylvania. And I went to school. I went to a couple of places for undergrad. I went to Boston University and Wesleyan University. And then I took about a decade off and I worked as a freelance writer and an English teacher in a high school and a few other jobs. And then I decided I started at one point right after undergrad a PhD program in English literature. And I didn't really take to it. And eventually after about a decade of working as a freelance writer, I realized I really loved writing about stories and poetics, but, I wanted to have a more ethnographic component. I wanted to write about stories that I actually heard people, telling out there in the world rather than, you know, sort of the canon of literature. So I went to graduate school at the University of Texas at Austin, which, had an interesting component in the cultural anthropology program there. At the time, it was called folklore. Then it's been called different things since then. But basically, it was a fifth field of anthropology. Anthropology typically is known as a four-field discipline. This was a fifth field other than archaeology, physical anthropology, cultural anthropology, and linguistic anthropology. There was this fifth field called at the time folklore, although it wasn't traditional folklore. It was basically what we call expressive anthropology. And it was a place where you could really approach expressive culture, vernacular artistic culture from an anthropological perspective. So that is where I did my PhD. And so that's my educational background.
I didn't realize you were also a New Jersey girl.
Oh, yeah.
I am as well.
Oh, are you? Seems like a lot of us are.
I think so. We go on to do great things. What can we say?
Yeah, right.
So now let's talk about this most recent book, The Resonance of Unseen Things. So how did you get the initial idea for this book?
Well, I sort of fell into this, this book in a way. I was in graduate school and I had started to do an entirely different ethnographic project, a more traditional ethnographic project in many ways. And yet I was interested so much in the way people tell stories about experiences. And I started to go just sort of for my own interest to this abductee encounter group, or sometimes called an abductee support group. The name changed over the years. And I became completely immersed in this community of people where storytelling was just completely front and center for how people communicated with each other and understood life. Stories were just, you know, the atmosphere that people were creating. And, you know, so I thought, well, I'll just, you know, write a few papers on this. I'll just keep hanging out. I really like these people. These people are fascinating. And pretty soon it became clear that this was a book length sort of project. So I just stuck with it.
And what did your research for the book entail beyond sort of attending that initial support group?
Yeah, so that was where I did a lot of research, was in the support group and also in the kind of community and that it generated. That sometimes there were groups that split off. There were communities of people that had I met through others in the group, and so I did a lot of research, hanging out with people who were around that community, in a fictional town, a fictionalized town, in the book. And then after that, I went to the town of Rachel, Nevada, a few times, and listened to people talking there. And this is the town that's closest to what was then a kind of secret military base called Area 51 that had a lot of UFO sightings and mythology and accounts and reports. And there was said to be a UFO hidden by the government at Area 51, and it had become a place of UFO tourism, as well as just a kind of a rural place in the American West. So those are the two main places where I spent time talking to people. And then the other part of the book is really textual, looking at the ways in which stories circulate, not just, you know, face to face, but, you know, through books and magazines and movies and the internet, and how that happens historically. So I don't make much of a distinction, I don't think, in the book between all of these venues of circulation.
Once you had sort of gathered these different kinds of materials, what does your writing process look like? You know, do you write on paper first, by computer? How does that all start for you?
Yeah, I love that question. It would be great to do an entire show asking people that. So I feel like my particular writing process changes as I go along. So I have to, at this point in my career, I have to allow for the fact that I have a pretty long sort of gestational period where it seems like nothing's happening, but in fact, I'm thinking and dreaming and ruminating and, you know, seeing connections everywhere. And I might not get a lot of actual writing done during that time, but I think it's really essential to how the eventual writing is going to emerge. And then I brainstorm a lot. I kind of just start writing. And this is, now it's always on the computer. I used to write longhand. I feel like that's atrophied for me, unfortunately. But I do. I write just pages and pages. And what I do, actually, I have some tricks for myself. Like, for example, in that early stage where it's sort of hard to get going, I often pretend that I'm writing to a specific person or people. One of them is as somebody whose vision I respect enormously and who's been a big influence on me. And I imagine that I'm writing her a letter. Sometimes I imagine I'm writing a letter to somebody else who I would want to understand what I have to say. So in that way, I'm always trying to think of the writing as basically having an addressee at all times. And it makes it, and it just sort of remind myself, you know, I'm trying to say something to somebody. So I just keep that dialogic structure in mind, and it makes it much easier to write. Then I start to actually kind of do outlines and organize what I'm going to write. And then at some magic point that we all, I think, long for and live for, eventually you get to that click where it's just flowing. And that's my favorite part of writing, where, you know, in the earlier phases, my desk has to be organized exactly a certain way. And if there's a dog barking five houses down, it's ruined my day and all of that. But then at some point, you know, I'm writing while I'm waiting in the dentist's office, and, you know, I'll like be writing on my phone in the supermarket line, and that's where it's flowing. So I think that these are the different steps. And then there's the revision, of course, which also can be difficult when you have already laid the grooves and you're trying to rechannel the flow of some of the material you've already laid out. But that's also, I think, a really important part of writing for me.
I love that. And I also really like the idea of framing that it takes longer to write a book than you would like as a long gestational period. Yeah. I plan to use that. But I do think it's true, right? That sort of percolating time when the ideas are just kind of sitting there and they're flowing in and out of the front of mind to back of mind as you're working on other things. I do think that can be really productive. Yeah. And so when you do your writing, is most of it at home, or do you write in an office?
I do both, actually. At home, I have an office that I really never use. I don't know why. I've changed it up so many times, hoping that it would be a good place to write. But no, I write at my dining room table at home. When I'm kind of really deeply immersed in a difficult part of writing, I tend to write on a couch under a blanket on a laptop. And then I like to, there are parts of the writing process, like especially things like editing or revision, or parts that are maybe tedious in some way. I really like writing around other people, in a coffee shop, sometimes with a friend. I have a friend who I like to get together with, and we write together. But that has to be at a time where, you know, I don't need complete silence or solitude.
That sounds great. I like that mix of strategies. But then just for my image of it, when you're writing under a blanket, do you mean that there's like a blanket across your lap, or are you literally like a ghost under a sheet? Like, is there a blanket? Yeah. Are you hiding? I'm picturing my 5-year-old, you know, like hiding under a blanket.
No. Oh, I love that image. No, I know, like the tent or the fort. No, it's not quite that romantic. No, I mean, I'm kind of almost just huddled up, you know, with a blanket on top of me, sitting on a couch in the most comfortable position as possible. Because in a way, I think writers need to sort of try to forget the sort of the physical kinds of discomforts that can start to impede your writing. And so maybe that's why people, you know, smoke or eat candy, or I am a total addict of LaCroix. Like, I'll just go through a terribly ridiculous number of these cans of carbonated water. And so the blanket and the couch is something similar, where you're trying to maybe, I don't know if this happens to you, Carrie, but you're trying to sort of turn off all the physical noise in your environment. And so sometimes just getting really comfortable is the only way to get there for me. So
I don't think I don't have the couch parallel, but I do have, I feel like no writing is so difficult that a cup of jasmine green tea doesn't help, right? I feel like, really, how much could I complain as long as I'm drinking a nice cup of tea while I'm doing whatever it is
Excellent.
I'm doing?
Yeah.
Well, so then let's turn to the book itself. Mm-hmm. The very first line of your book is, this is not a book about UFOs. So what is it a book about?
Well, when I say it's not a book about UFOs, of course, I mean that in a few ways. I mean, I'm not trying to either prove or quote unquote debunk the existence of UFOs. I'm not trying to enter that debate at all. in fact, the existence of those debates. Like, what does it mean to even debunk something or to try to express that something exists? Those are structures that I'm interested in, and I see them as completely dependent on each other. I mean, the idea of trying to disprove something as irrational or enchanted or unscientific has a history and has a sociality to it. So I'm not trying to enter into anything like that with, is this, you know, do you believe in UFOs or not? I'm also not trying to do a kind of traditional sociology of UFO belief or anything. I'm not looking at a bounded community. Instead, I became interested as I listened to people talk about either UFOs or other kinds of uncanny experiences and memories that sometimes had some connection to UFOs or appeared to people that might be connected to UFOs, that in the mid-20th century and onwards in America, it seemed that the UFO was a sign that stood for an entire range of experiences and memories that weren't totally reducible or containable. And the cultural experience of living in that realm of uncertainty, indeterminacy, insistence that there is something more to life than what meets the eye. The UFO sort of allows people to enter that world socially and discursively in a way that isn't always encouraged in, you know, kind of ordinary society. And so what I started noticing was that what people would do is they were developing this aspect of experience, kind of building a world that included the possibility of UFOs through talk, was that they noticed themselves that there's all sorts of different stories, both ordinary stories of life and uncanny stories that resonate with each other, that have points of similarity, that have coincidences that become very meaningful. And I think this book is about several things, including what it means for people to understand that these resonant experiences tell us something about life that we can't necessarily always explain through one story alone. So I guess I would say in a way that this book is kind of about how uncanny encounters resonate with other kinds of more kind of materially recognizable experiences, although those ordinary kinds of memories might be collective or historical. So I think, you know, it's about this resonance that people understand and becomes a kind of creative and poetic expressive activity and a way to theorize all sorts of in this case, American experiences of power that surround, different kinds of captivity and freedom. When you think about it, freedom is the sort of quintessential American trope, right? It's like this, the country was founded for religious freedom. We have freedom. Everything is about, you have, you know, agency. You can pursue the American dream. But the other side of it is of freedom, of course, is containment and captivity and abduction. And UFOs are linked with abduction, and the abduction narrative of, you know, space aliens abducting people is very similar to a lot of other stories that people either tell or recognize having to do with various kinds of containment or being caught, whether those are explicit, like, you know, something like slavery or Indian captivity narratives, or whether they're just these sorts of general senses that we have, affects, public feelings of being caught or stuck or feeling like there's some kind of power that operates in ways that is just too gigantic for people to understand through any one lens. And so I really think the book is about the ways in which people try creatively to express this more full sense of power and life and being caught and the fact of the sort of the something more, the something that's beyond what you can just necessarily say, I know exactly what this is, right? It's unidentified, the flying object. So that's pretty much what it's about.
Well, yeah, I really like how you frame the book from the very beginning that, you know, rather than trying to think about UFOs in terms of what is real or unreal, true or false, you're prompting the reader to consider, you know, what happens when we listen to UFO right. talk ethnographically, rather than in that sort of true-false binary.
Right.
And to sort of follow on what you said about resonance, I was really interested in your discussion of the term apophenia, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Right.
The experience of perceiving connections between random or unrelated events. But as you ask, you know, who decides what's related or unrelated? Right. And I'd love to hear you talk a bit more about that.
I started to read about apophenia and psychology through psychology. And sometimes when I talk about my book, people really want to go quickly to the sense that, well, you know, this is deluded, or, you know, conspiracy theory is you know, creating parallels where none exist. But as you know, if the line that you just quoted, you know, is something that we would have to ask as anthropologists, of course, when you're trying to not pass judgment or to defer judgment, certainly, but to listen to people, the ability to have the authority to say, okay, you know, this is a conspiracy on this plane, and this is a conspiracy theory on that plane, or these are patterns that exist because they're sort of objectively, repetitive in some predictable way, and these are patterns that are just in the mind of the beholder. Well, all of those ideas have a kind of social and cultural aspect to them. So, you know, if certain people say there's a pattern here and it's automatically dismissed, that tells you something about the privilege of who is really in charge of saying that their reality, their worldview, their experience is just somehow empirically truer than somebody else's, you know?
So yeah, absolutely.
I think that's the great thing about ethnography, basically, is that you aren't being asked to decide something like, you know, whose pattern is real. You're asked to decide, what does it mean to say something is a pattern, and to have your insight accepted or dismissed.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I talk to students about doing ethnography, that, you know, whether something is right or wrong or good or bad is pretty much the least interesting question that you can ask.
Yeah.
Right? There are so many more interesting questions.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is when you're I don't know if you find this, Carrie, but when you're working in the United States, your peers and readers are much more likely to want to disprove the patterns that are seen by the people whose stories you're telling. Like, I feel that if I were writing about, you know, some other kind of uncanny experience that was less familiar to people, that hadn't been in the tabloids, that wasn't a way that people sort of said, no, I am not that, you know, I'm not going to be connected to that. That's not rational. Then it would be a little, it would be more common sense for people, the kinds of people who might read this book, not to try to dismiss it or say, you know, this sort of, you know, pattern finding is you know, not to pathologize it, basically. But when it's close to home, people get very invested in the kind of social register of the pattern. And that's thoroughly connected to all of this.
Well, and I was going to ask about this later, but it seems like now would be a good moment for it, that, you know, I have found also doing research in the U.S., particularly in the projects I've done that were on relatively privileged groups or individuals, right? When I studied high-tech workers, it was right after the dot-com crash. So there was a sense that unemployed tech workers must be these, you know, young upstarts who flew too high, too fast, and are, you know, they deserve what they got, right? So I was sort of writing against a certain narrative. And I think one of the challenges of a project like yours is that many readers already think they know the people you interview.
Yep.
because they're familiar with caricatures of abductees or experiencers that circulate through American culture and media. And I was sort of wondering, how did that shape the resulting book? Yeah. The fact that you know you're writing against certain
images. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you said it perfectly. I felt that I was writing against certain images the entire time. And I felt that the people who I was talking to were really aware of stereotypes, were aware of being kind of dismissed by more kind of mainstream or scientific communities. Now, it's interesting because in the last couple of years, things have changed to some extent. There's a much more robust scientific and interest in UFOs, and the possibility that there might be something out there has been, has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post. I mean, there's, you know, evidence. I mean, the United States has always secretly and sometimes not so secretly tracked reports of UFO sightings. But all of this is starting to kind of get a lot of attention right now. And still, that still isn't the same necessarily. It's not all the same thing to talk about UFOs in a kind of scientific register or even a kind of register of what has the government been hiding isn't always the same as being, let's say, somebody who's seeking a particular way of understanding all sorts of forms of power in the United States. So, I was just very aware that in academia, it's often very easy to dismiss people who are close to us, but are not us. And when I say us, I am not even necessarily including myself, but I'm just putting us in quotation marks, you know, that there's a sort of image that there's some kind of, you know, mythical other, but the mythical other who is sort of right next door. And we define ourselves against people who are kind of close to us, but are not us. We all do that. And there's a way that people who believe in these sort of devalued or debased sorts of things like UFOs or other things kind of become symbolic of a kind of close other that creates a dismissal that I really did want to push against.
Well, and one of the things I found that was so interesting within the book is that, you know, even within this sort of story of people who tell UFO stories that go beyond the, like, they don't exist sort of narrative, you note that there are different kinds of UFO stories. So one of the most interesting contrasts you present is between the way members of the UFO experiencers support group discuss the uncanny and then the scientific discourses, on the other hand, that are employed by members of the mutual UFO network. And I thought the contrast there was really interesting for groups that probably are very often lumped together.
Right.
And then, you know, I also found it really interesting that you wrote of the support group, and you said, in here, the main thing is that you are going to be believed and heard while you swim head on into the weird. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe you could tell us a little more to invoke, what does it feel like to be a part of that group?
Yeah, I mean, it was wonderful, really. You know, there are even in terms of the narrative of UFO abduction, there's an abduction narrative right now that probably everybody is familiar with, where, you know, you're sleeping or driving and the little gray aliens with the big eyes come and abduct you. You have missing time. They experiment on you. They might take your sperm and eggs. They might create hybrids and they return you. And This is a convention. You know, I'm not saying it happens or it doesn't happen. Again, I have to be really clear. But the ways in which we tell stories become conventionalized. There's always something that you foreground and something that you background. That's true of any time you tell a story at all. There's always something on the cutting room floor, right? And this particular story of the kind of clinical traumatic UFO abduction became kind of rose on the narrative arc of Uncanny America in the 1980s and remained there. And for some believers, that was the kind of, that was the sort of master narrative, if you will, of UFO abduction, and others were probably not true. They were sometimes called, you know, confabulation or fantasy. But if they were consistent with that story that was heard over and over again, especially under hypnosis, then, you know, then it might be real. And other stories were just muddying the waters and making it more difficult for this story to be believed. But the people I knew and know today understood the UFO as a way to kind of connect the sense that there's just more to human experience. There's more to memory. There's more to states of consciousness than the kind of ordinary ways in which we tend to just organize, you know, reality versus fiction, say. And people have a lot of strange experiences. I mean, this is something I can say is a human universal, is we have different states of consciousness. We have encounters with beings that don't seem thoroughly human, but don't necessarily seem to be any kind of classifiable animal. That we have experiences that seem like they might be dreams and they might be memories, and we're not quite sure what they are. And that entering into that sort of liminal social space, making it something that isn't just sort of some weird thing in the back of your mind that you try to forget about, or convince yourself it didn't happen, or just sort of think like, yeah, that's this weird thing, I'm embarrassed for anybody to know about it, but to actually cultivate it, to make it the basis of your social world, to feel like exploring it is worthwhile and important, and that doing so opens up the world in a particular way, not just through, you know, the actual weirdness that you experienced, but that it pushes back against a kind of expectation of, you know, just a very kind of black and white, rationalized, understanding of what's speakable. And the UFO became a way to organize all of that. So, you know, I love thinking about this as the weird. And the weird was, for me, the way people often talked. People talked about something called weirdness or the weird. And the weird is, you know, it's kind of a scary topic if you aren't interested in pushing pushing against the kind of non-weird. Yeah, so that's what that was. I thought it was a way that people could really connect with each other around this aspect of being human. And then within that, there's a politics to it, because that was a place where people often tried to think about aspects of power in America that might not necessarily be easily theorized. So...
Well, that, you know, you note the sort of political context in which the mm-hmm. sort of alien craze of the mm-hmm. 1990s took place. And I'd say that conservatism and radicalism thread throughout mm-hmm. the work in mm-hmm. complicated ways. So maybe could you tell me a bit more about how you do see politics?
Yeah, I mean, I saw this, as you know, this book took a really long time to be published for various reasons, but by the time I actually decided to, you know, make this into an actual book and publish it, we had gone from a period of time where conspiracy theory, for example, or anti-government sentiment or affects around the sense that there is a kind of they working behind the scenes and that different kinds of power structures were connected. All of that was pretty marginal back when I was really doing the bulk of this research. And then a lot of those beliefs got taken up in the mainstream, and a sense that there can be conspiracies, a sense that you know, there's sort of more to power than meets the eye. These all became much more kind of politically legible affects, especially in the last decade. And so what I see here is the sense from before it's really recognized as having a mainstream reality to it, or any kind of relevance to the mainstream, let's say, there were already a lot of people talking about power, talking about the fact that there has to be something more than what we see, talking about the fact that the kind of master narratives that we live by aren't enough to really explain things, talking about the ways in which history sort of builds up and resonates with whatever is happening now. And you can see the seeds of this, the sense of urgency that this isn't enough, you know, that the kind of explanations, or the kind of quotidian master narratives that people live by, they just weren't enough. And so there's already this sense of, you know, that something is missing, something is wrong. You can't quite put your finger on it, but there's something that isn't quite right. And then that public affect, which is seen as marginal just a couple of decades ago, well, I think it becomes, you know, something that gets picked up on by people who do have power, and gets elaborated on in all sorts of other ways. But you can see that these sorts of affects, that something isn't quite right, that something's missing, that things are moving along at a pace that doesn't make sense, all of those feelings are already there, you know, long before they've been discussed as relevant to the mainstream or politically relevant in a mainstream way.
Well, and thinking about power, I mean, one of the continuing themes throughout the book is this idea of mm-hmm. they, right? Mm-hmm. The they in quotes, or the powers that yeah. be, and who they are. And what do sort of they represent, and how do they fit into the stories that you heard?
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of one of those irreducible mysteries, right? I think talking about they is a way of theorizing that in modern capitalist society, you really can't just pinpoint an individual or a specific organization who's responsible for the ups and downs or any of the vicissitudes of injustice or, you know, collapse, loss, sometimes bounty, that there's an entire structure of things, and some people benefit and some people really lose out. And it's very difficult to say who it is, who's making it happen. I mean, who is morally responsible for the kinds of shifts that, let's just take climate change, for example. When there's systems in place that nobody can really quite grasp, there is the sense of they really makes a lot of sense. You know, it is a shadowy sort of agency, but it's not that nobody's responsible. Some people are profiting. Some people are, you know, acting in their own interests. And yet it's really difficult to tear it all apart and point fingers at specific individuals or agencies. So it's a way of talking, I think, structurally about power. I really do.
I like that. I find that really compelling, and also, mm-hmm. I mean, talking about resonance, right? That sort of resonates with me in a way, that sort of this idea of sort of conspiracy, or the mm-hmm. unidentifiable they. Of course, they are unidentifiable yeah. in the complexities yeah. That make up our economic and political mm-hmm. and cultural system, right? Especially now, perhaps always, but maybe especially
yeah.
now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I also thought it was interesting. This is rewinding a little bit, but you talked about the way that individuals use UFO stories to connect to mm-hmm. one another. And I was also interested in the way in which those UFO stories connect to other kinds of stories. For instance, you've mentioned captivity mm-hmm. narratives from mm-hmm. early America. And that was sort of a left mm-hmm. turn yeah. you took in the book, that I wasn't mm-hmm. sure what to make of at first. But then the more I read about it, the more there did seem to be, you know, resonance there. So I wondered if you could talk a bit about the connections you saw and yeah. why you feel they're significant.
Yeah. Well, when I first started talking to people who I would say are really interested in UFOs, either abductees or people who just are really interested in describing their belief with each other. People talked about Native Americans a lot. And now there are certainly Native American people who also make connections between UFOs and indigenous societies. But here I'm not really talking about, oh, did you know aliens build the pyramids or something like that. That's an entirely other discourse that I'm really not talking about. I'm talking about this sense that people had that the experience of being colonized by technologically superior beings from another world, which could be how you would describe alien abduction today, resonated with what happened in our own country from the 15th century onward. And people often talked very empathically about, you know, I think that this must, quote unquote, you know, this must be kind of like what it was like to be, you know, indigenous to North America and have these strange ships come over and dominate you. You know, maybe that's what's going on. Maybe we are being dominated by another group that has technological superiority and is, you know, basically going to colonize. And I heard that so much that it seemed like part of the story. And so I started to look at these early American stories of captivity. Really, the first, I write about the Mary Rowlandson story in the book. These captivity narratives from the beginning of what it meant to be, you know, American, as opposed to just, you know, English in another place, were encounters with others. And the ways in which these stories of whites being captured by Native Americans, this just became a genre, became a convention really quickly. So what wasn't told were all these stories of Native Americans being captured by Europeans. And when you have one story that just becomes really dominant, that becomes really foregrounded, and another story that becomes sort of invisible, you realize something is happening, something cultural and political is happening there. And really, these stories have structural similarities to the UFO abduction story. So, you know, I'm thinking about resonance. I'm thinking about why these stories kind of connect to each other for people. And the captivity is this point of deep resonance. And it's a way of thinking about encounter and being othered and the earth, you know. So, you know, I saw the, not that I think, and it's very important not to say that a UFO abduction story is really, you know, just symbolic of some other kind of real story. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the way people organize and narrate their experiences are part of the kind of historical narrative fabric that we have as our birthright and that we enter into and that helps organize and make sense of the world for us. And we have this history, right? We have this history of the fact that America was founded on the basis of many kinds of violent captivities and from dominating and colonizing Native Americans to slavery, and that these stories are still with us, right? They're still circulating quietly. They still make up what it means to be American. And these UFO stories use many of the same kinds of imagery and tropes and kind of narrative components that some of those other historical stories do. And it seems like it's not, again, I'm not saying, well, one is real and one isn't real, or one is symbolizing and the other one. I'm saying that all together, they create a world. They create a kind of a web of experience in America of captivity.
Well, and I think in addition to trying to put the book into its historical, into their historical and cultural contexts, you also think about regional context, right? And the way in which this Western context of the cities that are associated with UFOs, like Rachel, Roswell. And how did the West and ideas about the West shape shape the book or shape your understanding of the UFO stories you were
hearing? Yeah, it really did because, well, first of all, it's important to, you know, anybody who's listening to this who is interested in this topic will know that there are UFO sightings everywhere. There have been abductions everywhere. New York City, I mean, really, the first kind of classic UFO abduction was in New Hampshire in the early 60s. But there's something about the American West, which has been so particularly mythologized as this sort of site of heroic colonization, that the stories, and it's also an incredibly militarized place. It's a place where, you know, the kind of colonization of Native peoples and militarization happened so much in the same spaces that, you know, it's also become a place with a lot of UFO tourism. And all of these stories, you know, they when you're there, you see them happening side by side. I mean, quite literally, you could get a, you know, a pamphlet about, you know, a how to kind of what kinds of things to do in the West. And you might see UFO go on a UFO tour and go on a pioneer tour all in the same booklet, you know? So, so these really echo off of each other.
No, they definitely do. And again, those sort of the resonances between them are interesting. And another sort of angle of approach that you use in the book is your choice to represent excerpts from interviews in the form of poems. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about that decision and about how poetics figure into the study.
So I had to think about what resonance meant. I didn't want it to simply mean I myself was taking these stories simply for their content and then trying to kind of create parallels between them. Instead, what I saw was that telling stories in a particular way that foregrounds resonance is actually, I believe, a human expressive creative activity. I think that every time we tell stories, we're doing something creative and expressive. And it wasn't just that people were sort of making these meta comments about this story is like that other story. A is similar to B. It was the way in which people told stories that you could start to hear resonance, you could hear parallelism, you could hear images that would kind of sound like other images. You could hear basically, you know, just the sort of poetics of talk coming through in the way people told stories. And, you know, because of my own interest in human talk as a kind of unmarked expressive form, I listened for the way people talked, not just for what they said, because I believe that the meaningfulness of what we say has to do with the form, the structure, the kind of poetic qualities of what we say, and that carries meaning as much as the content does. So that's one reason that I put these stories in as poems sometimes, so that you could really kind of feel the intensity, the urgency, the kind of the power of a story is not only about what is being referred to, but is in the words themselves. So that's, you know, I really think that when people tell stories to each other in ways that have a kind of urgency to it, there's often a kind of expressive quality to it. I mean, a good example, a good parallel to that might be like, let's say you are a congregant at a Christian church, and you believe completely in what the preacher is saying. You believe in the content, you believe in what it's referring to, but there's also a mode of preaching which uses perhaps powerful kinds of poetic devices that helps carry that message, that helps produce that message. It's both at the same time.
Well, I mean, thank you. You've given our listeners a great sense of your book and its arguments. And I'd love to know, you know, for you, as you were writing it, what was the hardest part of writing the book?
The absolute hardest part of writing this book was worrying that people would, that readers would dismiss the people I was writing about. And that, you know, that there's a stigma against certain kinds of belief in our country. And I was worried about possible stigma. And also, I just think writing ethnography is difficult because you, you know, it's impossible to get everything right. And I was doing a lot of fictionalizing. I mean, I purposely played with this so much, but and I say this over and over again in the book, that I change details to protect people's privacy, because a lot of this stuff can be stigmatizing. And even if people at one point think that they want to tell the story publicly, they might not want to a couple of years later. And so the hard part for me was worrying that people would misread me, because really I have nothing but respect and interest and empathy and, you know, basically real intellectual respect for everybody I was writing about.
And so if that was the hardest challenge, what was the most fun to write?
Mm-hmm. Well, the most fun is just that I love this stuff. I mean, seriously, Carrie, I felt that the intellectual energy, the ways in which people were trying to pursue what's real and what's true, I mean, the energy of that, the way people pushed me to constantly be questioning, I wish academia was that intellectually curious. I mean, it's just, you know, the question of what is real is a deep philosophical question. And I loved going there.
So if readers take home only one thing from your book, what would you want it to be?
I would want it to be, I think, that it's really important to pay close attention without rushing to judgment, especially right now. We are in an incredibly difficult, polarized moment. It's easy to stereotype people. I think that it's important to try to listen to people without reducing people, and to try to hear other people's experiences, even if they don't necessarily match with one's own. And I hope that doesn't sound too kind of, you know, nursery school, like let's all share and be nice to each other. But there's a way in which the irreducibility of the of another person really has to be attended to and respected, that I think is missing right now, and that I would hope would come through in this
book. Well, and I think maybe it's perhaps true more so for this book, but fundamentally, to my mind, that's the goal of all ethnography, right? That's sort of, I think, why most ethnographers gravitate towards it, that listening closely and being up close to actual people, it's very difficult to dismiss their views in a way that it is easier to do so, to either dismiss or misunderstand or misconstrue. When you're right up close, it's different.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Well,
absolutely.
I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me. But before I let you go, what do you think your next project will be?
Well, I've written about some other things since then. As you know, I've written about like reality TV shows, especially about consumption, practices of consumption. But right now, I've actually been writing about this new movement, especially among American younger people who are diagnosed with some kind of neurodivergent diagnosis like ADHD, especially ADHD, and how they are creating societies and communities for themselves on Tumblr. So it's very different in many ways, except there's a lot of similarities too, just because this is this way in which people are creating a world that has to proclaim that there's a reality that other people don't necessarily see. I've been writing about that a little bit.
Well, that sounds great. I can't wait to read the work that comes out of that as well. And maybe we can do another interview when that one comes out.
I would love to. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Susan. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today.